before an ocean trickles the walloping window blind. No gale that blew dismayed a crew or troubled the captain's mind. The man at the wheel was taught to feel contempt for the wildest blow, but it oft appeared when the weather had cleared that he'd been in his bunk below. Boatswain's mate was very sedate, yet fond of amusement too. He played up scotch at the starboard watch of the captain tickle the crew. And the gunner we had was apparently mad, he stood on the cannon's tail. Fired salutes in the captain's boots with the teeth in the booming gale. The captain sat in a commodore's hat and dined in royal way on toasted pigs and pickles and figs and gummery bread each day. The rest of us ate from an odious plate of food that was given the crew. Number of tons of hot cross buns chopped up with sugar and glue. And we all fell ill as mariners will on a diet that's cheap and rude. The deck shook when he dipped the cook in a tub of his gruesome food. Vessel ashore on the gullaby isles with the poop who smiles and the angles and his roar. Cinnamon straws, pink and blue was the pleasing hue of the tickle-toe-teaser's claws. We sat on the edge of the sandy ledge, shot at the whistling bee. Binnacle bass wore waterproof fences, they danced in the sounding sea. On a rock of a bar from dawn to dark, we fed till we had grown. Uncommonly shrunk when a Chinese junk came up from the Torby zone. Left the crew on the junk to chew on the bark of the rug of our tree.
When you decided to delve into these poems musically, did you, as you approached each one to write music for it, did you have the style in mind, or did that arrangement come later?
No, the musical settings and, you know, the stylistic decisions that I made were all responses to the poetry, and whether it was a response to where exactly, who is this character that's featured in this particular poem, or where did this poem take place, or who was the poet and when and where did they live? Is that what I'd like to reference? Or maybe just the rhythm inspired a certain type of choice. You know, like with the walloping window line, this is kind of rollicking. There's a couple to shift for an ocean trip with a walloping window line. And it seemed like it had to be an Irish jig to me.
Right.
But then to reinforce that, it was a poem on a nautical theme and, you know, traditionally Celtic music. can really, you know, conjure up images of the sea, you know, the fiddle and the pipes and the whistle. So there were so many factors I took into account when I made my decisions about what style of music, you know, what setting I was going to give, musical setting I was going to give a poem.
Yeah, you do range so far and wide with klezmer and reggae or ska and
Chinese
and yeah, it's
chamber orchestra, Cajun, bluegrass. Yeah, it's all over the map.
Yeah, wonderfully varied. So let's talk a little bit about how this project started.
Well, in 2003, I had left my major label and I'd started an independent label and put out a folk record, and I was pregnant, having my first child, and just was living a different life than I had previously, and was staying in one place and was having more quiet than I'd had in years. And I started to, once my daughter was born, I started to read more poetry, and I started to immerse myself in juvenile poetry because I wanted to eventually introduce her to this. And started with researching lullabies from around the world and then revisiting a lot of the poems and stories that I had read as a child. I mean, this is pretty normal. It's what most parents do. But I found the language, especially in the simple Mother Goose rhymes and the lullabies, to be so beautiful, so simplistic, so evocative. And I was moved to start putting these to music because I had these creative impulses, but my hands were full. I couldn't really spend a lot of time writing original music, and it was just a really interesting way for me to work, you know, to use this found poetry
as your inspiration.
Mm-hmm. When and did eventually I worked on the project for 7 years, and as she grew older and we were experiencing this together, the music and the literature, the themes became a little heavier, and the language and the poetry became more sophisticated, and it just sort of paralleled her growth and her, you know, evolution.
So you kept researching and finding more sophisticated poetry as she grew?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how the Jared Manley Hopkins piece ended up, and ended up being included, and the Charles Cosley and the Robert Louis Stevenson poem, The Land of Nod. These are all poems that touch on loss of innocence and aging and nostalgia for childhood. And it's amazing how quickly children become nostalgic. By the time my daughter was 4, she was nostalgic for being a toddler. When she was 3, she was nostalgic for being a baby. that time in your life when you're not responsible for anything. All your needs are met. It's kind of a dreamy state to be in, and it's hard to let it go.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of children, even as old as 5 and 6, have moments when they just want to be cradled because it reminds them of that. You know, it's not like the helplessness. It's that they were constantly helped. I think that's what they crave.
Yeah, it's interesting. We think of childhood as such an innocent time, but really it is full of very sophisticated emotions and feelings.
And I think I'd never in my life experienced such a great degree of terror as I did as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at 5 or 6 years old, I can remember lying in my bedroom and shadows passing on the wall and being terrified to put my feet on the floor because something was under the bed.
Right.
You know, the terror of the unknown is really vivid, and with such a vivid imagination, anything's possible. So there's everything to be frightened of, and all that is reinforced by parents.
Right.
You know, in my case, my parents were Catholic, so I had the devil to contend with. You know, the appearance of the Virgin Mary potentially if I opened my closet in the middle of the night.
Well,
into Easter bunnies and tooth fairies and all, and elves and witches and ghosts and aliens from outer space.
Isabel met an enormous bear. Isabel, she didn't care. There was hunger, there was ravenous. This big mouth was cruel and governess. They said, Isabel, glad to meet you. How do Isabel, now I'll meet you. Isabel, she didn't worry. witches come see the sprinkle. Oh, oh, Isabel, oh, it's grow. Turn you into an ugly toe. Isabel, Isabel, didn't worry, Isabel. Didn't scream or scurry, showed no rage, showed no rancor. Turned the witch into milk and drank her. Oh, yeah.
As they get older, you have to introduce them to the real boogeymen, which are other human beings.
Mm. Are you getting to that point now with your daughter?
She inadvertently saw a newscast when she was 4 of a Palestinian home that had been bombed. And in Europe, you know, we spend a lot of time living in Europe, and the newscast there, she was with my mother-in-law for a visit. My mother-in-law left her in front of the television while she went to make lunch, and this is what she saw, and it haunted her for weeks. She had nightmares, and a woman with her bloody child in her arms, and that's really, it wasn't, and you know, we don't have television in New York, and I really monitor strictly what she's able to see that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, the little chipping away process that happens away, it happens early, you know, much earlier than you expect.
Going back to the poems, back in the 19th century, where many of these poems come from, they really dwelt in that land of childhood imagination and created and brought all these sort of icons of childhood, princesses and dancing bears and the desire for autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And class differences, that there's a lot of that in juvenile literature,
right,
especially from that time. How did you do the research for these poems? Where did you find them?
Well, I started with anthologies and then branched out from there. I thought there's no need to reinvent the wheel. But Natalia Crane is so obscure. There would have not been any other way to find her. But once I found her, I went online and found a rare book dealer and ordered several of her books. And so that's how I did the research, through libraries, through online searches, through anthologies. It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Once I discovered someone really obscure, I wanted to know more about their lives or their life. And so Arthur Macey and William Bridie Rands and Albert Bigelow Payne, these are some of my more obscure poets. It turned into a Nancy Drew mystery. Found people through death records, and we found literary executors, and we found surviving family members. I've had tea with William Bruddy Rand's great-great-grandson and held first edition copies of his books.
Churches were built in the sea, and if 3 times 1 was 9, then the world would be upside down. Yes, the world would be upside down. What a topsy-turvy world this would be. World would be upside down. Yeah, world would be upside down. And if buttercups ate the cow, if the cat had the dire disaster to be worried by the mouse, then the world would be upside down. Yes, the world would be upside down. What a topsy-turvy world this would be. World would be upside down. Yeah, world would be upside down. World would be upside down. If mama sold the baby to a gypsy for half a crown, if a gentleman was a lady, then the world would be upside down. Then the world would be upside down. Yes, the world would be upside down. What a topsy-turvy world this would be.
What are some of the more interesting or exciting discoveries you made about some of the poets?
Well, some of, like Christina Rossetti, I didn't know much about her life. And I started this whole project with her collection of poems called Sing Song. And I just assumed that she had had several children, and from the amount of elegies that she'd written for children, I assumed that she had experienced, you know, the death or several deaths of children at a young age. And as it turned out, she was a spinster. She never married. So that was, you know, even though she's a really well-known author, poetess, that was a curious discovery for me. And then I'd say William Bridie Rance, the fact that he had two families simultaneously, different sides of London, with I think a total of seven children. I found that really fascinating. And I think that poets tend to live pretty outlandishly for the most part.
Yeah, you probably have to step outside of regular life to spend your life in words. You say in your introduction that you think that poets are the soft-spoken clairvoyants of the world. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, clairvoyance just means clear vision, clear sight. And I feel that that's, the nonsense poetry aside, but when I read poetry that illuminates some universal truth, that's when it is most powerful to me. And sometimes those truths are obvious, and sometimes they're hidden, and I think the poet is able to see them, you know, accentuate the visions that are apparent to everyone, but maybe we just don't see them as vividly, or to uncover truths that we either deny or we deny their existence, or maybe we just don't have the perception to see them.
You talked about frightening images of childhood and what it's like to be a kid. And some of your poems in here, some of the pieces are very frightening. And one of the ones that really leapt out at me is the one by Robert Graves called Vain and Careless.
Careless.
About the woman.
Frightening, the thought that lovers could be perfectly suited for each other and never encounter each other.
Well, even more in the beginning when the lady gives her baby
away.
Give
the child away.
I just wonder how children...
So casually.
Yeah. You know, I think it's one of the shocking things for a child to hear about a mother giving her child away.
Well, it's hyperbole. It's a literary device. And I think it just quickly spells out the woman's character. She gave her child away. Bring him back the next time you're in town, basically.
Yeah,
because she was vain.
Right.
And I think that when the next character is introduced and his vanity is shown through the fact that he always walks on stilts, I think maybe even a child would understand that this is a fairy tale. We're dealing in symbols more than in symbolic language, more than in reality.
Lady, lovely lady, so careless and so vain. Once when a beggar called, she gave the child away. The beggar took the baby and wrapped it in a shawl. Bring him back, the lady said, the next time you call. Live he would walk on stilts to be seen, to be seen by the crowd. And up above the chimney pots, tall as a mast, all the people ran about shouting till he passed. Such a splendid match, surely. Neighbors saw it plain, although she is so careless, although he is so vain. But the lady played by Cherry, did not see a care as the vain man went by her. Aloft in the air. So this gentle bond couple lived and died apart. Water will not mix with oil, nor vein with careless heart.
Do you think that children who get to hear poems like this, who are brought up with that kind of metaphor and imagery, are able to incorporate it into their own way of seeing the world?
I think so. Some children are born with a natural inventiveness and wild imagination, and others, it has to be encouraged. I think children who are never told fairy tales and never read nonsense or never presented with absurdities or ironies, maybe they grow up like little adults and they, you know, everything's cut and dry and factual. But I feel like that's part of the job of a parent, is to free children's minds or keep them free. It's almost like most kids are born with that innate sense of creativity and openness.
Hmm.
And then it's, you know, gradually hammered away.
Right. Yeah. We get shut down.
And they're not, you know, their system of logic is not the same as ours because they have limited knowledge, and I really like that. There was a great anecdote that I heard on This American Life years ago about children and the way they perceive logic, and it was this little girl gets on an airplane for the first time, and she turns to the woman next to her and asks her, "When will we get small?" Because her perception is that airplanes leave, go into the distance, and become smaller. So obviously we're about to shrink. And I love that my daughter is always coming up with these theories that are completely absurd to me, but I understand how she comes to those conclusions.
Let's talk about a few of the songs. One of the ones that's so evocative for me is Equestrian by Rachel Field.
Circus imagery. Mm-hmm. It's really powerful. For children and adults, these are people that live on the periphery of society, and they come and they go, and they bring with them this fantastical life. And this is from A Circus Garland, which is a long poem by Rachel Field about the circus coming and leaving town. but I just extracted the portion of the poem about the equestrian.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. And I had a wind quintet and a string quartet of the arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to make a calliope, and then at the same time, you know, sort of graceful passages that evoke the girl in the pink tutu on the horse, you know, doing acrobatics on top of a moving horse, and then imply the, you know, the rhythm and motion of the horse too. So it was really fun to write that arrangement.
See the clearing, the sawdust calls for the girl in pink on a milk white horse. See the girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. The spangles twinkle, his pale flanks shine, every hair on his tail is fine. See the girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. While his hoofbeats fall like rain, over and over and over again. Bright as a comet, his mane blows free as she points a toe. Seem more beautiful to me. As a girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. As a girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. So beautiful to me. As a girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. As a girl in pink on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. As a girl on a milk white horse, cantering over the sawdust calls. Thank you.
And when I put together the whole album, I was reminded of the way that a circus is a conglomeration of all these elements that don't seem to relate to each other. I don't see why someone taming a lion should have anything to do with a man being, you know, shot out of a cannon, or a beautiful Russian woman, you know, spinning on a rope hanging from her teeth. They're all they're discrete events that don't seem like they should have anything to do with each other, but they're combined and they become the circus. That's why I feel like all these poems really had nothing to do with each other. They were all written in different, you know, most of them written in different times by men and by women from different countries. And I had the job of bringing them all together and making them cohesive in a way, making them relate to each other to the point that I feel like there's almost a narrative that takes place between the characters now that I've put them side by side. You know, the sleepy giant somehow interacts eventually with the girl on the horse, and the girl on the horse somehow interacts in my mind with Isabel and Griselda and so many of the other characters, the peppery man and the giant in Isabel. It's funny.
Yeah.
How in my mind there's this cavalcade of characters.
How lovely to have all those companions, if you will. So as you tour with this show, how are you approaching all of those different styles? Do you just have an amazing band that can handle everything?
I do have an amazing band. I've got an 8-piece group. And within it, we have a string trio. We have woodwinds. We have piano, accordion, string instruments, banjo, guitar. But they're really versatile musicians, so we can, you know, the woman who's playing the fiddle can do the Balkan folk, and she can do the Chinese folk, and she can, you know, pull out a hoedown when she needs to. And everyone is really enjoying, all these musicians are really enjoying the tour because it's demanding so much of them to play these different styles. And they don't get that opportunity very often. It's pushing them.
Terrific. Well, it sounds like it's going to be so exciting.
Yeah, and we're doing the full program of introducing people to the album, and then we do, usually in the encores, we do my catalog selections.
Can you say why it is that you gravitated to the mostly 19th and early 20th century when you were looking for poems, rather than more contemporary poems?
Well, it seems like a golden era of children's literature, especially in England. It's almost like childhood was invented. This idyllic childhood was invented then, which is ironic because it was a difficult time to be a child. I feel the quality of writing was really high. So many of the people who wrote for children were not exclusively children's writers. They wrote adult works too, or they were, you know, a lot of these writers were gentlemen who just wrote for their amusement. So maybe it wasn't so consumed with commercialism.
Like
it seems like some of these writers were just kind of shocked by the amount of attention that their work got. And some dismayed because it wasn't really, even someone like Edward Lear, it wasn't his legacy, his chosen legacy. It wasn't what he wanted to be remembered for, being the most prolific author of nonsense in the English language.
Right.
He wanted to be known as a great landscape painter.
Well, it's again, it's a very beautiful collection, and I'm sorry that we're out of time. I would love to talk to you about The House Carpenter's Daughter also, so I'll just tell you that I continue to play that CD very often.
I think there's a kinship between the projects. I did a lot of research and dwelled on other times and, you know, the work of other people when I did that project. So it's kind of a prelude, I guess, to this project.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.